Okay, Reboot FM 88.4 in Berlin. This is Reboot FM, Achsenach 4 in Berlin, live aus dem Transmediale. So, again, this is another live little transmission from the Transmediale Festival at the Haus der Kultur in der Welt in Berlin. Now we are starting a new round of discussions, and this is with Reboot FM's very own Pitt Schulz, and he is discussing a few topics with John Young and Deborah Nastios, and they are actually the architects of information. That's one of their projects. They do something which is cryptome.org. I have a hard time pronouncing this, and I'm sure they will correct this. This is actually something which is a kind of pre-WikiLeaks archive of many documents that were leaked that are very controversial, classified or otherwise. And yeah, they have, you know, I'm actually going through this. In the last 15 years, over 65,000 uploads. And it survived dozens of corporate takedown orders and hacker attacks. And I have to say, Deborah Nastios and John Young are as convinced as ever that all information must be free. I think I'm going to leave that as the introduction. They're quite, I think, renowned figures within a larger community of people that are interested in making sure, keeping governments and institutions accountable and using documents to do that. So Pitt Schulz is going to take it on with my John Young and Deborah Nastios.
Yeah. Good evening. Can you say something to the microphone to test it? Hello, John Young.
I'm here.
Good. You hear us, Diana? Good. Hello.
Hello, Deborah. There.
Deborah, you are also an artist, right? And not only an architect. You had an exhibition lately in New York.
I had an exhibition in Los Angeles last spring at the Dem Passwords Gallery on West Adams Street.
So before we speak about cryptome, I think we should take a chance to talk about your art. It's political art, I would say. That's as much as I understood. And it's somehow using material from cryptome or topics about surveillance and the city. But there's also material I found very interesting from Greek history of migration. So I mean, you are an architect, but also an information architect, so you have a special visual style. Maybe you can just introduce us to your art.
Well, I like very much you searching through this bouquet of various titles and role playings, because in fact, it is a kind of ill-defined collection of practices that we have that I don't really establish very sovereign boundaries between. We flow very easily from one to the other. We take material and activities and content from one depository and shift it into the other practice. And so it's a continuity. It's a spectrum of practice and activity. So to say artist, architect, information architect, cryptome, licensed architect, licensed by the state of New York to practice in New York City, it's all an amalgam of borderless performance.
Mm-hmm.
And so my visual work, in fact, is very cartographic in nature and of a political cartography, a political geography, very narrative, and a counter-narrative to dominant geopolitical narratives from post-war years on.
Exactly.
So cryptome figures in that because cryptome's landscape is in that contra-narrative landscape of content that defies strict itinerary, state borders, and so on. So it's a very interesting landscape of constant redefinition and invention. And so every day as we begin our practice, it's a thrill of the unknown.
So you both have a background as architects. But you particularly, I found in an interview, have a background in intelligence community from the family. So you want to talk about that? You want to disclose it here?
I certainly do because, in fact, the new work that we premiered at Transmediale on a couple of evenings ago in the Anxious to Secure stream had very autobiographic, autobiogeographic elements buried in, which is typical of my work. But yes, I grew up in the Cold War context in a CIA family, and we moved. If I list the countries we lived in during the post-war years, you will see a trajectory of geopolitical interest by the Pax Americana. Mm-hmm. And so this is the context of my being in the world during early years, being in a very, being very locally in Greece, Vietnam, France, Korea, the Netherlands, Argentina, Iran, being very locally in situ as an emerging young person, but always with the narrative of the Cold War sort of hovering beyond the domestic perimeter.
And there you are, having this formidable, extraordinary archive of the godfather of WikiLeaks. Julian Assange basically took the model of Cryptome and made it kind of into the Time magazine. But you are doing this since the 90s, the mid-90s, I would say. Since I'm basically on the web, I know about Cryptome. I don't know, when did you start Cryptome?
1996.
Yeah, so we started NetTime about the same time. That was like the time where people were still believing in the hacker ethics of information has to be free. It was long before open source was called open source. Probably was known from the intelligence community more than from the hackers community. The open source documents. So you are known to be releasing every day a package of highly classified documents, more or less classified, from various institutional contexts, corporations, internal documents. Maybe you can just start somewhere where you. Maybe we can start with Echelon, because it was discussed here as a source of the Snowden discussion. But you can also take any thread you like where you would say this is where the moment where Cryptome started.
Well, it started with us joining the mailless cypherpunks in 1994. And, of course, that's the start of Assange as well on cypherpunks. And there are dozens of people who got a start on cypherpunks in the mid-90s, and so it deserves all credit for what's going on now. So in 1996, we started to publish documents from members of that mail list who had access to documents through their work but did not want to be associated with their release because they saw what was coming. With the wind down of the Cold War, this technology was going to be released to corporations and was going to be turned into the commercial market and against the public. Formerly, it was only directed at nations. So they knew that was coming because the jobs were drying up in the intelligence services and the contractors, and so they wanted to get this information out there. So they started to give it to us. We had a scanner and a computer, and so we started scanning and putting this stuff online, and they would do it only on the condition that they were not identified. So that was the start, and one of the nice things about it, we didn't know what this material was. We could not understand it ourselves, but we knew how to put stuff up. And that comes back to a predecessor, which I won't spend too much time on, that I personally started doing this kind of work in 1968 at Columbia, and where I first learned about social protests and activities parallel to your career, in which we set up a group to do this kind of work. To correct our education or to supplement it and to not get stuck into a career path. And so that continues. So Cryptome is an outgrowth of that for me. For Deborah, she has a different origin, but both of us came at it from a particular direction of not wanting to be stuck in a career or not only there, but to find other ways to engage with the public we were ostensibly to serve. But, of course, we found out that we were being trained to serve an industry, not the public. So that continues.
That was a time of the Vietnam War, Watergate affair. So, and the Weatherman, this was somehow your context where you started.
That's correct. In fact, the Columbia Strike Committee, Mark Rudd and others, for a brief period of time, was stationed in my apartment when they got kicked off campus. And so that I had a family, a bunch of kids in there, and they came in with their wonderful attitude toward whatever they did. And so it was a thrilling experience to be exposed to young people's enthusiasm and they're shucking the career path. And so they took off another direction. We took off into a somewhat more restrained direction because the group I worked with did not like high-profile activities, did not seek celebrity. We thought we should do public service quietly and not ostentatiously, and we continued to do that. And so that, of course, distinguishes us from a number of high-profile people now. We don't like high-profile activities. We think that corrupts the process. And particularly, we learned to distrust the media because the media really trashed the student protest. At least in America, I don't know what happened in Europe where May 68 becomes something of a different signal. So for us, it was important to dissociate the use of media for one's own personal career. So we've tried to avoid that.
Mm. And you still call it a hobby, Cryptome? I mean, in the other talk you said it's a hobby. I mean, 60,000 documents 25 years later. It's a kind of a serious hobby, huh? I mean, there are not so many other cryptomes around the world, so it's a kind of rare hobby also. And it needs people.
If you don't mind, I'll give credit to those who are doing this long before us. Yeah. One is the National Security Archive in the U.S. It's been doing this fantastic work. You must go to them for really great stuff. They get tremendous amount of material from the government through FOIA. But one that's even older than them is the Federation of American Scientists, which was set up to oppose the nuclear war. Mm-hmm. And the nuclear armaments, and they're still the stellar group composed of scientists, engineers, and truly responsible people. And they are far more capable than we are at doing this. And now they are funded. They are well established. They do great work. However, they don't like what we do. Mm-hmm. We've been told they don't like what we do. The phrase they use, you go too far. Mm-hmm. And we say, yes, we go too far. That's what we're up to. We want to go where others won't go. Mm-hmm. And that has led to some confrontation with the authorities, but I think that comes with the territory. We learned that in 68, too. If you go too far, you will get visited by the authorities. Mm-hmm. You got to accept that. We've not yet gone to jail, but which means we've not really gone far enough. We think if you don't go to jail for your beliefs, then you haven't gone far enough. However, we haven't gone. So we're not that courageous. And nor do we want to encourage anyone else to go so far that they go to jail. But we do know disclosure sites that would encourage people to go that far. They never go to jail. Their sources do. And that's what we got a beef with. We don't think that the media, our lawyers or others who milk these sources, ever go to jail. And we think that's unfortunate. I think that is a deception operation.
Speaking about the sources who are sending you these materials, which are not, before they're sent it to you, they're not part of the public domain. Do you have any kind of idea where they're located in statistically? I mean, they're mostly from the U.S., I would say. Some international.
Well, it's important that we get Deborah's view on this before I get carried away. But my view is that disclosure should be done extremely quietly. It should not be done ostentatiously. Mm. One is because that separates you from the consumer. Mm. And consumers don't believe high-profile people. They know what they're up to, that they're up to their own agenda, not in the interest of the public. So you got to do it very slowly and in a way that people can absorb it in their own terms. And they don't need stories to be told to them. And we part company with journalists who think they've got to explain things to the public. We don't believe that. We think that's how it gets corrupted. And so we think that is a con job of people who think they've got to explain to the dumb public what's going on. And so we have no narratives on Cryptome. We put up documents. You make up what you like. And we warn people to don't trust us. Mm. Don't trust any disclosure site because they're heavily surveilled. They're recorded upstream and downstream, and we don't have any control over that. And we dislike the notion that disclosure sites say, we can protect you. They cannot. That's a deception operation. Media can't protect you. And so we like to poke fun, actually not poke fun, stab in the eye these folks who deceive the public about security. And we don't know of any site out there who is truly honest about the surveillance they participate online in particular and on telephone through the architecture of communication. Mm. Every site has log files. Mm. If they deny it, they're lying, because there are log files upstream and downstream, and you cannot control that. And so those who don't understand how the internet works are deceiving people. Those who know won't admit it because it's too lucrative to keep it quiet. So we think that all these public service organizations who are supporting Snowden, WikiLeaks and all, are not telling the truth about how their visitors are being logged. Mm. They try, but they don't go far enough, let's say. Mm-hmm. So we think every disclosure site should say, don't trust us. Do not believe we can protect you. Mm-hmm. And see what happens after that.
But usually you get these documents through PGP, I would assume, from sources who are, you don't know. Also kind of addresses you can look up on a PGP server, of course. But in another moment you said that you have a kind of information that a lot of them are coming from a local area, which I found interesting, that there is some kind of local fabric attached, let's say, in a Manhattan area, that a higher percentage of documents which are leaked on Cryptome are coming from a, let's say, a local
I feel uncomfortable geolocating.
Yeah? You cannot say that. Yeah?
Geolocating any of this, okay. The origins.
Yeah.
As far as you know, almost nothing comes from the New York area. You can't believe how dumb New Yorkers are about this.
So it's not
so
New
they're
Yorkers
arrogant. No, they think no. They're on top of things, and they're not. They're hustlers.
Yeah. New York is filled with hustlers. It's not local, but I don't think geolocating the sources is productive, really. I think we have to maintain a kind of geographical neutrality about boundaries and jurisdictions and accept the transaction, a trusted transaction. And I think it's important to repeat what John said about the current corporate media business model of celebrity as an income producer and celebrity as a sensationalizing, titillating device for increasing the value of content is something we stay away from. It's deeply cynical to sensationalize this trusted transaction between someone who comes with a document and puts it forward to you. It, particularly as Cryptome is a modest undertaking, we cannot promise, and therefore one has to be understated about the transaction.
So you're hinting on Jesse Manning and
let me name some names.
Yeah. There are some
ACLU, one of the most corrupt organizations in New York City and around the world. We detest how they're handling Snowden. They're using him for fundraising purposes. Meanwhile, they're turning down more needy people because they're not good for fundraising. Mm-hmm. Look at what these folks are paid. Phenomenal salaries are being paid. So phenomenal salaries are being paid to The Intercept. This is a corrupt organization to get these kind of salaries out there, while others who provide them information are either going to jail or getting nothing. And I think that's the pattern that's going on now under the national security realm. Now, I should say National Security Archive and FAS do not do that. But some of these newcomers to the national security field. Now, ACLU is an old organization, but we know some people who have left ACLU over this issue because they become money-driven, not public service-driven. And they refuse to have anything to do with ACLU. And that's a tragedy because it once had a wonderful history. Now, the question is, who else is on the list? Well, we think there are some others which we'll hold off for the moment, but there are others who are also smelling the coffee of money-making because they think, well, you know, we've been at this for 30 years. We've got to pay our bills.
Well,
we've got to put
people through
college.
Well, as you know, the neoliberal model includes the nonprofit world. But the nonprofit world is now in a groupthink in terms of its operational practices. There are consultants. You get a master's degree in nonprofit management, and they're all following the industry best practices on fundraising and so on. It's very uniform across the board. Whatever organization, you get the same formatted letter responding to the same news cycle trigger stories that will generate generate funding. It's part of a homogeneity of business practice that is quite startling. But all of these nonprofits who are within a particular tax structure in the U.S. and therefore they have their accountants and tax lawyers consulting them have all had to, because of their board members or whoever their fiduciary consultants are, fall in line with these industry practices. So it's no longer a voluntary ethically driven, but very much a best practices driven in the fiduciary sense, and extremely troubling.
Let me say a nice word about WikiLeaks.
Charity market, where also now Alphabet and Bill Gates Foundation and Ford and the big ones, they're competing with each other in the non-profit sector. Yeah, it's probably what Germany will also have to face.
And did you know that it's lucrative tax write-off to set up a non-profit journalism organization? That's why so many are popping up, because they're considered a hardship industry. Mm-hmm. Isn't that absurd? But it turns out Amador saved a lot of money by setting up First Look, because there's a big tax write-off for a hardship industry, as though it's some farmer
threat
out there somewhere. Mm-hmm. So when you see Bezos and other people investing, it's for tax write-off.
Yeah.
And so a number of nonprofits in the media world, oh, the decline of investigative journalism, oh, blah, blah, blah. That's the hardship side. Well, it turns out that's the result of heavy lobbying to be declared a non-hardship industry. Bingo. And when you look at their tax reports, you see what they're getting paid. Tor is one. Mm-hmm. Another one that is running a scam operation. And so the thing is that they have a heavy dose of PR going.
Radio Free Asia, right? Radio Free Asia, the Open Technology Fund. Mm. I mean, isn't it the kind of old Cold War propaganda, Cywar money going into Tor? I mean, can we say that?
It's almost all government money. Look at it, almost no private money. Amador has been involved, State Department involved, almost nothing. Now, they ran a little fundraiser recently because they were getting such heavy criticism for being a government operation. And so now they said, well, we are, but what can we do? So when they get exposed, say, oh, well, this is a real world. Would you stop bitching? We know you're jealous. Mm-hmm. And so they've gone through all the cycles of that. But then you look at what they're actually now helping FBI break into Tor using the child pornography excuse. And so one of the Snowden documents said, oh, NSA can't break into Tor. Not true.
Yeah, well, I mean, I don't know. We are very loyal here to this community because we're part of a network here. But on the other hand, some kind of inner critique is can be also seen as constructive. I think these questions are important to be posed. So you can say whatever you say. We have free speech.
Wait,
here.
You just said some inner critique could be. You said that very tentatively. And cautiously. You should say that robustly. That robust dissent within any organization is crucial in a democratic context. Don't apologize for it.
Yeah. I just try to harmonize here because I'm getting signs here. But I think it's very interesting to see. I mean, let's speak about Tor again. And as a kind of, where is the strategy of Tor? As I understood it, in the beginning it was about field workers in a kind of enemy territory to be basically protected. It's classic spy technology. So it was for activists working in a kind of, let's say, in a certain crisis area. In the history of clandestine radios communication, to be anonymous. So, and for that use case, then kind of because the internet doesn't have borders. Has a second use for the people in the U.S. or in the West. So, but this is a kind of collateral damage of something which was supposed to be in the beginning really for targets in, let's say, China or other areas. Could you confirm that? And then you had to create a narrative around it, around cyber freedom and all of that. But as a tool for intelligence services, it has certain use cases, of course. So it's an interesting example where certain, you know, damages are coming with certain technologies. And you just mentioned this something similar where now the cyber doctrine is mixing together the defense department with the attack department of, I think, NSA and from the cyber war, U.S. Army. I think they're kind of starting to reorganize. Maybe you can talk about that in the context of cyber war, that somehow Tor is part of that, you know, stack of tools. Yeah. So we are weaponizing our communication also.
Yeah. Well, two things that happened in this session of meetings. One is yesterday we were in a session which activist was used as a disparaging term. We hadn't heard that since 1968. Rather than it being a term of approval, it was a term of disparagement, i.e. you're too far out. We've got to be reasonable and responsible here. Now, that I pick up on that because some people use it casually, but that's what I mean about the neutralization of term. For example, surveillance is a corrupt term. Mm. You should call it spying, not surveillance. This is a softening term. It's an aggressive, violent act of spying. Even spies use the word for spy. They don't believe in surveillance. This is an aggressive. They said, we break laws. We break into people's lives. We do damage. But the PR people won't say that. And so the thing is that we're adopting the wrong language. We're softening the issue, and that's because we're scared shitless or because we're just mimics, monkeys repeating what other people say. So the use of the term surveillance is corrupt, should not be used anymore. Or if you use it, say, well, what we mean by surveillance is polite spying in which you don't really harm anyone. We don't do any injustice to anyone. It's all so polite and it's approved. Now, that's why they cooked up the term in Britain to use surveillance or intelligence, which is an even more devious term, for actually creating harm in people's lives. And so we think something very peculiar is going on now because, as we know, for many decades, no one paid attention to an invented term called national security, which was invented in, 1947? Again, as a kind of a cloaking term rather than we're going to go out and hurt you in some way. So, yes, what happened a couple of weeks ago is the director of NSA said in a public meeting, we're going to meld information assurance, which is counterintelligence, with intelligence gathering, which is spying. We're going to blend those two. We kept them apart before. Now, what has not been released very much by Snowden is counterintelligence, how you defend against spying. They've raised the alarm about spying, but they haven't said what to do about it. Even today, we're still hearing claptrap about surveillance and Snowden documents, how much they tell us, but they don't say what to do about it except talk about it a lot and hold debate and go to Congress and hold conferences and write books and give talks and make documentaries, do art about surveillance. But it's all because we can't talk about counterintelligence. We can't talk about what to stop this shit.
Well, it's because
that's too classified. That's above top secret.
It's very interesting that Ed Snowden in 2010, when he goes with Dell to Tokyo, one of his functions is as a CI trainer, a counterintelligence trainer, at a quite high level, he claims, for China counterintelligence. And that whole experience of his, that shift into the counterintelligence mode, then precedes the acceleration of him moving towards 2013 and moving from booze in Hawaii
to Hong Kong.
What
we hear is that the knuckle-draggers
so
spy.
That,
the intelligence people do counterintelligence. They do counter-spy. And so they send people out to do clumsy work. You need them to come in?
No. It's cheap. But this is very interesting. Snowden himself, we will have a big conference in March, the Logan conference here, where the whistleblower debate is getting continued around investigative journalism. And they have a very interesting goal there to ask an investigative journalist to collect their kind of unfinished research material and kind of share it, even if it's used or not used, to at least share the background material of investigative journalists, which is one of the practical goals they have there. But on the other hand, it will be again around Snowden as a kind of, let's say, like a hero for civil rights. But it's not being mentioned often enough that his job is he was part of the intelligence community, so he was a spy. So, and knowing about, you know, coming from Berlin and knowing from the 80s, the Cold War situation of, you know, Klinika Brücke, exchanges of spies, there's a certain culture around spy culture, and that's often forgotten that Snowden himself was working in this environment. So, how can you trust a spy? You know, yeah,
you cannot.
Yeah, see,
you cannot trust Snowden. You cannot trust anyone who has a security clearance.
Right.
It's important that you understand they are trained to lie about what they do. Yeah. That's a requirement of their security clearance. So, one of the campaigns that we need to get going, if I were a community organizer, I'd say, is never trust anyone with a security clearance. Mm. Abandon them, don't talk with them, don't socialize with them, and certainly don't ask them to be a speaker or your friend, mm-hmm. because they are lying to you. They have to lie to you. And so that it's not a glorious role, it's a dirty role, and it corrupts civil society to have people with security clearances. We think all security clearances should be lifted, mm-hmm. and they have no protection for what they do. But let me give credit to several people who've actually done good work.
Yeah.
Winslow Peck in 1972 wrote about his experience with the NSA, one of the earliest ones who revealed what the NSA does. He was a low-level person, and he had to come out. This guy's still alive. Winslow Peck was a used pseudonym, and he now lives out on Long Island in New York. And Adrian Chin ran him down a few months ago and got him to talk to him. He did not really want to come out and talk it again because he paid a price for that revelation. But he did. He talked about it. Next, there was a woman who worked at in Britain for the NSA and discovered that the NSA was spying on Congress people and revealed it and went to Congress and testified about it. She told a reporter named Duncan Campbell, who's trained as a physicist, really knows his technology, and started to feed him material, and he started digging. And he still does. He's had access to a little bit of the Snowden material, but not much, because he's so far ahead of them technologically, they can't get him to gear down. And so a lot of stuff they're revealing, he's already written about. And then in 1980s, he wrote about it. Nikki Hager, first revealed Echelon, and now called Five Eyes. So this stuff has been around for a long time. And then, of course, the European Parliament did an investigation in 2000 for the whole thing. As someone said yesterday in our seminar. So this stuff is not new. Report. It's only new to people who've not been covering it. And they act like it's a whole revelation. Exactly. Thing is we think a lot of new stuff could come out of Snowden, because the thing is we've been short-shifted on the technology. How do they do this stuff? Mm-hmm. Now, Ducklin has dug hard, and a few people have dug hard, but the ordinary reporter can't do that. National security reporter now is something of a dog term. It's what you do and wait for handouts. Mm-hmm. And have lunch with national security people where they feed you tepid information. And every newspaper now has a national security reporter who never reveals anything except what a great job they're doing. But if you talk to Duncan Campbell, Nikki Hager, who's still out there, still writing, they have stuff that's really quite good. And it's depth, it has depth, it has richness. It's not glib. And they don't give you glib answers. They're getting short shrift right now. And don't know why Snowden didn't go to someone like that rather than these assholes he went to. So that's a story that hasn't been told yet. Why did he wind up with these completely technologically illiterate people to reveal this stuff to? Someone sold him a bill of goods that you need to make a lot of waves with this. Now, this is a so-called Snowden pact that we still don't know what that entails, which is that they get to do what they want to with it. Mm. Well, I think the guy was desperate because he'd been turned down by other people sitting there in Hong Kong, worried. Now, wait, let me just say, this is all based on fairly loose information, but it was a hell of a time to get anyone to listen to him. Mm. And so we don't know who fed him into this group and why they were so unable to deal with it except in one particular way. Our only hope is he put it with someone else on the quiet. With people who knew better and how to handle it better, and it's being dealt with another way, and that this whole rigmarole we're seeing now is a cover story. So we keep our fingers crossed there's something better happening now in the background, because that's where it should be happening and not in the front page of newspapers, which is a worse way to find out about national security. Because it's dealt with in a homeland like the way.
So you're critical about this spoon feeding the mass media with yet another few documents, and keeping the whole thing burning.
Criminal. Yeah. It's actually they're acting just like spies.
But
dribbling information.
It's a second secrecy regime that's been imposed now by the media proxies, and the assumption that there should be a media pathway to the public. Well, that could be a fallacy. There are technical people in reserve ready to review serious documents, should they be put forward, which they have not been. Not the occasional journalists, but serious teams of technical, digitally literate individuals who are looking for meat on the bones, and there's none to be had at this time. You know, if we're to believe the current media, Snowden's current media proxies, and his testimony through them, he's been extremely cautious and controlling about his release. He's wanted to have his cake and eat it, too. He's been extremely particular about what he wants to let go, evidently, and what he wants to be kept in reserve. Is it his choice at this point? You know, those are tax-paid-for documents. Mm-hmm. Those are taxpayer documents belonging in the public domain. And what authority does he have now at this point, where he opened the spigot, to now be controlling in a fairly doctrinaire and authoritarian way what happens to this trove, this cache?
Well, there was a quote by Snowden, and of course we only get quotes from Snowden. It's hard to know what he actually thinks or wants done. Is he said, "I gave this material to the public." Well, no, he didn't. He gave it to a bunch of self-interested journalists who decided to run a certain story with it, i.e. to explain it to people. And these fucking explainers really have got a problem.
It's a serious conflict of interest. They've made themselves, they've written themselves into the story as heroes, co-heroes of the story. Mm. It's a conflict of interest. They are not at a distance from their source. They've embedded themselves in the narrative. And therefore, all decisions are highly suspect, because they benefit from the outcome of the narrative in every sense.
And you think there are other ways which are also working, they're functional, and you don't need to go to the mass media. You don't have to do it the Hollywood way. You don't have to, you know, stage and spoon feed and dramatize. I mean, there are ways to do it scientifically, so to say, right?
They should go to people who can read the documents, not report on them. Yeah. Reporting is not honesty. It is headline grabbing. Mm. It is selling hyperventilation. Mm. And they call it reporting when, in fact, it's highly selective, highly literary in character, suffused with ads or nonprofit contributions. Mm. Give this stuff to technicians who can use it. By the way, we're on mail list with technicians. They cannot believe this stuff is being withheld. It says, we know how to build offenses if we could see this stuff. It's hinted at, but they won't release it. And they say, this is, when I use the word criminal, they're saying this is criminal behavior to imply that they've got it but not release it, because someone may go to jail, it may damage Snowden. These are all old cornards that are just not true. This is a standard ACLU story. We've got to go through legal means. We've got to have our attorneys vetted. We've got to check with the United States government as to whether it's okay. I think these are just tall tales, and they've been around for a long time. I mean, ever since newspapers have been around, it's been around. And the thing is that there are plenty of people ready to look at these documents, but they're just not given access. And it's a story that just hasn't been written about. Now, a few people have commented on that. You know, there's something called dual hat in technology, people who work both in the classified and the unclassified area, in which they can see both sides, but there are actually a pretty high wall between the two. And the question is, how do you do one without hurting the other? There's even something called dual-use technology, where it can be used for both military purposes and for civilian purposes, and you have to know the technology to know the difference. Hmm. There are a number of dual-headed people who allegedly have been given access to this material. Hmm. Thing is, though, it's so damn lucrative to see this stuff in the raw and not have constraints on it. Hmm. I could name a couple of interesting people who've been milking it already because they have been given access. But they're still out there beating the drum for public interest. But you can see already that they're using this to their advantage. Now, that's the corruption side of dual-use stuff. This may sound kind of exoteric, but I think that we at least have to be able to talk more about how duplicitous the intelligence world is. Mm-hmm. So if you talk to a spy, they're trained in duplicity. If you talk to a media person, they're trained in duplicity. If you talk to a professional, they're trained in duplicity. We're professionals. We know what we're talking about. So we have to think you've got to be honest about when you're being a professional, i.e. a liar and a cheat and a self-interested person, and when you're a true public servant, and be able to make that distinction and not blend them. So I think that the NSA is about to blend the two. They're going to use their information assurance people, who are pretty much the honorable, who build defenses, and they're going to corrupt them by putting in the same room with the spies who are. And so we'll see what happens. And by the way, the NSA head said there was resistance on both sides to melding the two because they've got their own culture associated with it. They don't trust each other. So we'll see what happens. We have high hopes that it will, what, explode?
I mean, there are different statements by the NSA about the gravity of this revelations by Snowden. But on the other hand, you know, after, I think, you know, 2.5 years, thinking back, the Untersuchungsausschuss in Germany going through its processes, what has been achieved, what has been done for the public after so many years. And I think the question is allowed to ask, isn't the NSA now becoming in the public eye or in the mass psychological behavior more powerful than it was before? I mean, in the Clausewitzian sense, it makes sense to let your army look even bigger than it is, you know. So, I mean, it's just an assumption. It's just one possible interpretation, but don't you think it would be very good to kind of reveal these documents to make sure that this assumption is wrong? You know what I mean? I mean, by now it looks that because it's so hard to defend, that these tools become almost omnipotent, and the Congress in the U.S. or the Untersuchungsausschuss in Germany, they didn't achieve very much. In the end, it's basically like the NSA is even winning through the leaking of these documents. They seem to win more than if it wouldn't have been leaked, you know. So this interpretation is, I think, something which is rarely discussed, but it should be also put on the table to say, look, we need to get more and much further access to the documents so that security experts can develop defensive means.
Well, I think you've got a good point because clearly, let's say the first chapter was to present the case to the public, in the court of public opinion. Mm-hmm. The public responded or not. Mm-hmm. Now it's time to move into the next stage of the campaign, which is to move into the technical sector.
Right.
We see now in the U.S. presidential campaign, there's a huge constituency for giving free rein to national security interests on the part of the public. The power is coming from below up. Now, in between presidential campaigns, you don't see the manifestation of that interest group to the degree that one does now, because the media is covering them and their opinions about American power, American militarism, American exceptionalism through military might and prestige. And in certain voting groups, that kind of military prestige is still the coin of the realm in this time of turmoil and uncertainty. They want to see that military. They want to see the NSA have full capability and more. And Snowden only demonstrates that there needs to, so that's a bottom up constituency. Therefore, having litigated this in the court of public opinion and arrived at the result that we have in the last 2 years, it is time to move now into the next campaign. But the documents have dried up. The activity is now extremely trickled. The spigot has tightened up. And so there you have it.
I think there is an official statement from Krypton where you ask for the full release of the documents, if I remember right. Yeah. When was it when you asked for the release of all the Snowden documents?
We kind of think we got set up by this invitation to come to this session because we were led to believe that the discussion was being about to get an agenda going to get the documents all released. Well, what we had instead was people talk about how to make the best use of the ones that have been released. And no one wanted to talk about getting more. And so we think we got cheated and deceived in a spy-like way. We got set up. So we'd like to disavow anything that happened during our participation here because Christian had told us that was a reason that he wanted us here because he had a movement going for that.
But it's not so much
people who've got a stake in not asking for more.
And it's not so much getting more. It's the principle of getting the full collection, the principle of all of that being forwarded into the public domain without the gamesmanship that we're seeing at the moment of the stewards, these media proxies who are stewards of the collection, who are self-appointed in a non-democratic way to determine their dissemination. And it's entirely their approach has been undemocratic and extremely proprietary. They jealously, proprietarily have hung on to this collection in an entitled way that is now embedded in their careers, their prizes, their awards, their personae, their growing celebrity in the culture, their now museum shows, and all the opportunities that have opened for them. This is simply not the democratic model at this point.
You know, at first, as they were sharing this with a number of media around the world, no longer. There's only one source now, and that's The Intercept. They no longer share this with other media even. And if I might say some breaking news, I just talked with a guy who's on the inside of that group who said, we totally agree with you that more technical information should be released, but there's going to be little chance of that because now the argument is that that would threaten Snowden's deal with the U.S. government. So now the agenda is to protect him by not releasing anymore. Now, we've assumed that was going on. And so the thing is, now what happens to those documents? Because this is a lawyerly approach that we're going to save this guy his heroic status. We're just not going to release anything more to the public. This is deal-making. Now, you know the U.S. government would love this idea. They'd love to offer some inducements, a pardon, a freedom, and just trash all this stuff. They've been trying to get it back and destroy it. And it may be that Snowden now has been shell-shocked enough to concur with this. He doesn't want to go to jail. Thing is that, well, so where's the public interest in this? So he may get a pardon. He may get released. The journalists have made their case, got a lot of attention, and the government gets the documents back. And so what do we got here? Well, they'll say, well, we made a little progress. We'll do better the next time. This is the best we could do. We tried. So there's a plea bargain going on. Well, it turns out plea bargains are rigged games. And often what happens is that what you do is you gang up on the victim, i.e. Snowden, and say, if you don't do this, you know what's going to happen to your family and your friends and your lawyers and your supporters, and they slowly peel away all your protective people or threaten them until you're left alone and say, do you really want to harm your best friends? And repeatedly this breaks their spirit, i.e. I don't want to hurt the people who've been supporting me. And so, yeah, all these other people who don't want to go to jail say, you can't do this to us. And we're going to save you, i.e. we're going to save ourselves. So I think that has to be done in public. I think that plea bargaining has to be made public. We'd like to see that take place. We've actually asked through FOIA for all these inquiries. We'd like to see, we've asked The Intercept to make public what they're doing in the background and not hide it. So that, too, is now part of the Snowden disclosure. What are you doing back there?
Yeah, the lack of transparency in the process.
Yeah.
Total lack of transparency.
And, of course, this idea that, well, we've got to work with what we can that came out of our seminar yesterday is a concession, concession of defeat that we're not going to ask for anymore. We'll work with this. Well, I'd like to call that cowardly. Why don't you run a risk of pushing for more and not settle for what you've got? And we've now seen several presentations of people making much of what they've got. And they don't want to hear that it's incomplete, deceptive, wrong-headed, exploitive, and cheating the public of an honest account that these are partial documents. They're not complete. They may be false. Some of them may be completely fake. We certainly know some of the classification markings are fake. Yeah. They don't do that anymore. That's not how they classify documents, by putting it at the top. Those are deception markings. They do it other ways. They're buried within the document itself, within the file, within the paper document. So they seem to say that because this has its classification marking, this is top secret stuff. Not true.
So you say it. Probably some of the slides were fabricated?
Yeah.
Probably.
Because spies put out fabrications all the time.
Yeah.
That's a counterintelligence operation.
Exactly.
You do not put out everything you've got to anyone. And you mark everything in multiple ways, including the easy-to-discover ways, because that's how you entrap people. They think they swiped it when, in fact, they've just pointed a finger at themselves.
But these folks are not familiar with how devious
spies are, seem to be naive about this for some reason.
You refer to some discussion on cypherpunks and from the security community. Bruce Schneier, for example, said something like that before. That, I mean, a lot of the, to name a few, Uniper or Cisco routers are compromised to have known backdoors. Probably some of the documents in this Snowden stash hint on that, but they're not getting released. That's in the interest of the security community to get access to this material and validate it and research it. So are you somehow in contact with, why isn't there some kind of document signed by known security experts to demand access to more of this Snowden material and put it under a certain license and give it to Cryptome, give it to whoever needs it. I mean, where is that movement happening? I can read it here and there, like your statement, Bruce Schneier's statement, but it's not coordinated so far. And
so your question is not, why is it not happening?
Yes, it's
not where you said where
it
is it happening?
Happen,
why is it not?
The question is why.
There's
not,
a reason that
it also didn't happen at Transmediale.
Happening.
We can say that here. I mean, it didn't happen here. You just mentioned that we are too often agreeing with compromises, successes of the past, and playing with the results and harvesting the possibilities from what has been achieved already. Which is probably not enough. But what would stand in between, like a next step, when you say, let's get full access to the material? Who's on the other side protecting that?
Well, someone who's allegedly inside the Snowden operation.
Yeah.
2 hours ago said there's got to be a public demand for these things to be released. They're not going to do it on their own unless the public demands that it be released. He says somehow we've got to get that campaign going because they're not going to do it by themselves. They need more public demand that these things be released. And I thought that was pretty interesting because the seminar we were in says, we can work with what we got. We don't need it anymore. They're not listening to people inside who want this stuff out, but they're not going to do it unless the public demands that it, or there be some interest group that demands it. On information security and communication security mail lists, there's tremendous amount of discussion about this. They're doing their best to extrapolate from what they've got and saying, if only we knew this, if we had this tip, we could close the gap. So they're trying to work with what they've got, but saying there's so much missing, we're afraid to make speculations. It says it's damnable to have only the teasing material and not the full stuff. And so they're talking about it, but don't forget, they too have got careers to worry about, so they don't want to go too far out and challenge. Don't forget who's the best customers of ComSec people, the USG. So they're not going to, and commerce, and so they're not going to go too far. So it's going to take those of us who go too far
but also, but in terms of the public campaign demanding, of course, as I mentioned earlier, there are campaigns that are resisting. There are the national security enthusiasts, grassroots up, who are always pushing for American military prestige in all its dimensions. I have a undergraduate mathematics degree from a college where a professor told me recently NSA actively recruits the mathematicians. It's a women's college. The women mathematicians actively being recruited. And NSA informally funding, attempting to fund programs there as they have, you know how many universities they are funding programs for, you know, emergent cryptographers and so on. So there are vast monies being spent across America in order to build up that constituency contra contra the sort of campaign that we're looking for. So it's not a campaign to occur in a vacuum. There is active resistance in the polity.
Yeah, if you go to NSA website, they actually list the colleges that they're funding. And there are hundreds. So they're not hiding this. It's there, and students are being induced to join this in future career. Of course, there are several million people who have security clearance in the U.S., much less around the world. And so that there's a vast industry in not making this kind of thing public. And so long as they get away with it and say it's for the national security, they're just not going to let it go. It's too lucrative. Now, what do you do about these millions of people who are making their living off of keeping this so-called oath that they're saying Snowden violated? And so it's going to be interesting as to people outside this industry opposing those who are on the inside. They are not going to accept this. Their lives are based on it. They've been at it for their whole career. And so that it's a good question. Why don't you tell us what you think we should do?
I think the election is coming, and that's probably one of the topics to bring in and remind people again what Hillary Clinton is somehow attached with companies from the military sector, I heard. So, I mean, these discussions would help to make a better decision, probably, of some of the Democrats who to vote, for example. I don't know which documents you could still hold on that to make some kind of connections on that level. I think that probably from the inner workings of the Democrat Party, there might be some people interested in these issues in a moment. And that Bernie Sanders is not completely out, I think that will be kind of timely right now. And the other thing I think is very important to have, let's say if you're a karate master, yeah, then where are the disciples who kind of continue with the work, you know, get taught? And maybe you know Paul, have you ever met Paul Guerin from New York, from Namespace? No?
No.
Okay.
No.
So he's not a disciple. Yes. But that's the hacker community. You know, like the first generation, us, me included, Gilmore and so on, they're probably not the target anymore to continue your work. But that's, I think that's also important to speak about the continuation of this culture we are standing for, you know, growing up with the student movements. You know, for me it was late 80s when I went with the student movement, but it had a relation with 68 or so. So yeah, that's what I'm concerned with in a moment, to tell this story. Diana wants to say something. Good. So we will have the last words. Diana, you want to ask something? Come on, you're here.
No, I actually would love to thank John and Deborah for this discussion and say, yeah, yes, there are lots of things I would love to discuss off the airwaves.
Yeah.
But of course, I'm always happy when people bring up my dear old friend Mark Rudd on our own radio. So
off the record.
I have to say, you know, that doesn't have to be off the record, but I'm also really happy when with your question is in a way like, what would you, in a way, ask of coming generations and so on, how should they carry on this kind of fight, and what is that fight? So.
Great statement, because Deborah's video has a question mark at the end. And that's what we want to say. We are not certain about this. In fact, we think there's more questions than answers. And we don't like people who are too certain. We think it's more important for the public to ask more questions than hear it from us. That's why we don't put our opinions on crypto. We don't offer opinions on crypto. We're out of character in this show. Crypto just gives you documents. You decide what you want to do with them. So you can't broadcast this.
Well, there is this generational issue now of young people who've grown up digital and the digital erotic, which has been part of their erotic lives. It's very difficult to break off that relationship and to become concerned about issues that perhaps their elders connected to student movements of previous generations have a more visceral experience with, of what, tear gas, being in the jail cell overnight or longer. And so this the desire that digital life responds to, the mirror that mirrors back, you know, these young people's desire. It'll be very interesting to actually now track generationally how these issues, how younger generations are connecting with these issues. And you mentioned upcoming conferences. I mean, I'm curious to hear from very young people on these matters, not us.
Exactly.
You know, we're all too old at this point. We want to hear from very young, politically ambivalent people on these matters.
Yes, I totally agree. And probably also from people in Turkey, from people in other...
Enough about Snowden. Yeah. We heard a wonderful talk today by a woman who talked about all sorts of interesting things and never mentioned the word Snowden. That was great to hear because we think it's overdone.
Yeah.
There are hundreds of issues that crypto publishes on that has nothing to do with Snowden that are probably more important. And so this exaggerated importance of Snowden is almost a hipster-type thing. And it needs to be toned down because there's very serious stuff that needs to be dealt with, and the Snowden issue is not a really worthwhile issue anymore. It's been done to death.
Yeah. I totally agree. That's why we are going now to the concert of Serhat Köksal. He's part of the anti-Erdogan movement in Turkey, Istanbul, and they're kind of trying to bring up the stories about the Çiçe and where the civil war is happening against the Kurds and a lot of crimes against humanity happening on within the European borders, so to say, and not being mentioned often enough. Okay, I'm switching over. Thank you, John Young, Deborah Natsios from Cryptome.org.
Thank you. You can edit this, of course.
Gözel Radyo.